and welcome to the new season of the Iran podcast. I'm your host, Negar Mortazavi, a journalist and political analyst based in Washington, D.C., and a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Today, we'll talk about the Biden administration's policy towards Iran and the broader Middle East and how this foreign policy, first of all, differs from the previous administration or not, and how it's impacted the lives of everyday Iranians in Iran and also Middle Easterns across the region. My guest today is Mortaza Hossein, a senior reporter at The Intercept, who focuses on national security and foreign policy, including on U.S. policy towards Iran and Iran's national security state. Mortaza is also co-host of the popular Intercepted podcast. Mortaza, welcome to the Iran podcast.
Thanks, Nagar.
You recently published a piece in The Intercept on how it's a, I would call it an old story, but we keep hearing new anecdotes and information and statistics. So you've done new reporting on how the continuation, essentially, of U.S. sanctions on Iran continues again to impact the everyday Iranians' access to medicine in the country. The piece is titled "Children Are Dying Because Companies Are Too Scared to Sell Medicine to Iran." And you explain how Joe Biden has kept Trump's maximum pressure sanctions, essentially the maximum pressure policy, as it was called, and that discourages even legal humanitarian trade that's exempted, supposedly exempted from sanctions, and impacts the medicine market in Iran. Talk about this report and some of your findings.
Sure. So a few months ago, some representatives of an NGO in Iran focusing on a particular disease called thalassemia reached out. They have a lawsuit currently pending in a U.S. court alleging that U.S. sanctions on medical companies, or not, sorry, not medical companies, but on Iranian banks that deal with foreign medical companies have made it impossible to import drugs to treat thalassemia, as well as this other skin disease called epididymis bullosa, which is another genetic inherited skin disease. Thalassemia is an inherited disease. It's a blood disease which effectively causes iron to build up in the system of people who suffer from it. So normally, you know, your body can filter out iron, you know, natural processes, but if you have the disease, iron builds up and you need specific drugs to remove it from your system, as well as regular blood transfusions. So if you're born with thalassemia, which many people in Iran are, especially in the south of the country, if you don't get regular transfusions and a supply of these iron chelating drugs, as they're called, you'll have iron buildup in your body, and that buildup will damage your organs. And it can, and very often does, lead to death. So starting in about 2018, this NGO shared a lot of communications it had with Western medical companies who make iron chelating drugs as well as bandages intended to treat epididymis bullosa. And effectively, in very clear language in many cases, these companies told their Iranian partners that we're very, very sorry, you know, we're happy at the work you're doing to help patients in Iran with these conditions, we support you for that morally, but we cannot continue to provide these drugs anymore because of the financial risk of these sanctions. So, you know, in effect, although the sanctions do contain some exceptions for humanitarian purposes, in practice, the exemptions don't really exist. Because to actually conduct the transactions necessary to bring the drugs to Iran, you have to deal with Iranian banks. And because of Trump's maximum pressure sanctions, Iranian banks are blanket banned from international transactions with foreign interlocutors. And, you know, whatever exemptions theoretically exist, they're very legally complex. And the sanctions are deliberately worded in such a way to be vague enough that the enforcement of them can be at the discretion of those you know, in the Treasury Department, whether they want to enforce them or not. They it's very, very hard to know where the lines are and what to do, even if you're selling humanitarian goods to Iran. Mm-hmm. So many countries, many companies simply decide that it's not worth the risk. There are very, very big fines have been levied against other companies or banks for dealing with Iran in the past, as well as reputational risk. There's organizations like United Against Nuclear Iran, or UANI, which obviously maintains very public lists of companies which deal with Iran as a way of inflicting reputational harm on them. So, you know, if you're looking, if you're a company which makes medical supplies, you know, Iran is probably not a major source of your revenue. It's probably relatively small or modest amounts of transactions you're doing with Iran. So it may not be worth the risk. And many companies have pretty much explicitly said that we can't deal with you because our fear of these sanctions. And, you know, while it may not be a crippling or devastating financial loss to a company to cut off Iran, if you're an Iranian who suffers from one of these diseases, like thalassemia, the loss of those shipments to Iran could be very devastating. It could be literally the difference between life and death. And what these NGOs have documented in Iran, what they said that they've documented over the last, you know, if you could say 5 years since the maximum pressure sanctions came into place, is about 600 excess deaths of people from thalassemia who didn't get treatment. And around 10,000 people who were injured or suffered organ damage as a result of not having, not being able to remove the iron from the system that these foreign drugs were able to do to provide. There are local equivalents to these drugs, but they're not, they cause complications. So, you know, you're seeing a lot of people suffering from lack of access to treatment to these rare diseases. And it's one of the silent and very predictable, but, you know, not very politically important, it seems, consequences of putting these very, very broad-reaching and, very, very wide-reaching sanctions over the Iranian population, ultimately.
Mm-hmm. So, Murtaza, you and I, when we speak to U.S. officials, I've also reported on this issue. I had a piece out in a Foreign Policy magazine about 3 years ago. This is during COVID and the Trump administration, essentially how the maximum pressure back then, which continues to this day, was impacting Iran's access to COVID-related medicine and medical supplies. And it was causing excess damage to the country's healthcare system and deaths. But when we speak to U.S. officials, you know, there's always a response that, yes, there are exemptions to the law. I'm, in fact, looking at some of the Treasury's instructions right now, basically explaining that generally the sale of agricultural commodities, food, medicine, and medical devices to Iran is allowed. So it's exempt under the law. But again, as you're explaining, there's what's on paper and what's actually happening in real life. But U.S. officials also blame the other side, the Iranian side, that, oh, if the Iranian state did care enough, they could have resolved this problem. They could allocate more resources. They could find ways to actually make it happen. Talk about that and how basically politics is playing a role. And then you're also saying it's not a big enough political issue to be tackled to get results.
So in 2020, many of your listeners are probably aware that the Swiss government helped create a particular financial channel to facilitate trade with Iran by European companies. Mm. Obviously, Europe was not on board, you know, with the revocation of the Iran nuclear deal. They're very happy with the deal, actually. And they want to try to preserve it and keep it on life support. So they made this financial channel, Instex, for the means of having European companies deal with Iran outside of, you know, potential Treasury Department or OFAC scrutiny. And it seems like it was quite a laborious process. It's not easy to set up alternate financial channels. You know, SWIFT and these systems are very, very important to global finance. But they did it. And, you know, the purpose was to make sure that European companies can keep dealing with Iran. The problem is that this channel seems like hasn't been used very much. There's been some trade with medical companies in Iran. Novartis, one of the companies which makes drugs for thalassemia, has done some transactions on this channel. But, you know, the next problem with sanctions is that obviously, and the US government's very open that this is a goal and they've taken some pride in this, is that it's to reduce Iran's foreign reserves. So when Iranian foreign reserves are down, even when there's some channel available in whatever limited capacity to do trade, there's not often reserves available to trade. So you have a multiple, you know, you're putting pressure on the Iranian economy on multiple fronts. And inevitably, you know, there are some things which are going to fall through the cracks. So Novartis said they were ready to do trade with Iran. They're not among the companies which said explicitly, which are many others, that we're not going to do any trade with Iran because of the sanctions. Said we're willing and ready to do it. We're ready to work with our local Iranian partners. But the issue is that there's not any reserves to do these transactions, or the Iranian government has not made available reserves to do these transactions, which is a predictable result of a policy aimed at reducing Iran's reserves as low as possible. Something's going to fall through the cracks. And from the Iranian side, it's a very opaque government. There's a lot of, it's not a, you know very well, and your listeners know very well, there's not free access to information about the internal workings of the economy. A lot of it's controlled by the military or, you know, organizations linked to the IRGC. So on their side, we can't say exactly where they're allocating funds and what transparency is to how much they're allocating towards humanitarian needs or with the other political prerogatives that they may be doing. What we can say is that the net results of the policies over the last few years have been a very marked scaling back on the imports of humanitarian goods to Iran. During the COVID crisis, we saw that very explicitly, Nagar, as you pointed out. But there are a lot of other diseases which have a very high prevalence in Iran and which rely on foreign trade to get the requisite medicines and supplies to the Iranian people, which have apparently dried up in the last few years. So if you're an NGO or even just a medical clinic or a doctor in Iran dealing with the subject, you're not going to be privy to how much foreign reserves there are or what restrictions practically and regulatory wise on trade may exist. All you see is that the end result is that the drugs were there before and now they've become rarer and rarer or even non-existent in the country.
At the beginning of your piece, you talk about this little boy, Amir Hossein Narwi, who died when he was 10 years old. And I know you've spoken to some other families and patients in the NGO. Talk about some of these real life examples, how it's actually impacting real people, children.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, you mentioned that case of the little boy who did not have the thalassemia medicine he needed. He passed away as a result of that. You know, there's this other disease which another NGO is a co-signatory to this lawsuit, which is also documented, called thalassemia bullosa, which I mentioned earlier. So effectively, epidemius bullosa. So basically, this disease causes sores to appear in your skin, and your skin becomes very, very tender. It tends to affect children much more because of the fact that, you know, children's skin is obviously more tender and more supple than adult skin. And when you have the disease at a young age, you know, the damage can be more extensive. And to treat this disease, you need specialized bandages. And the purpose of the bandages is that when a wound appears, if you put a regular bandage on it, when you tear the bandage off, it'll tear the whole skin off. If you have a specialized bandage, which are called Mepilex bandages, which are very specialized, made by only one company, that the proprietary type, you can change the bandage without the skin tearing off. So it's a very, very consequential difference. And the level of pain and discomfort that a patient experiences from a specialized bandage versus a normal one is very, very important. So there's a Swedish company called Mölnlycke, which makes the specialized bandages specifically to treat epidermis bullosa. And they told their Iranian partner, it's called EB Home, in 2018 in a letter that because of the U.S. economic sanctions, we've decided not to conduct any business in relation to Iran for the time being. Since that time, EB Home has documented a number of Iranian patients. They anonymized the names for their privacy, but they described testimonies from doctors and patients themselves who said that they've had excruciating pain as a result of having to go back to the normal bandages since Molniki cut off exports to the country. They've said that they've had a lot of, you can call it, cosmetic damage to their body as a result of not having the regular bandages or not having special bandages, especially to the face. So you can imagine for children who have this disease, which is inherited, there have been a lot of cases of people who the children are disfigured now. They have to live with lifelong disfigurement because a company stopped exporting to Iran, not because they weren't getting paid or because they had a problem with Iran themselves or their Iranian clients and patients, but because in their own words, in their own letters, they were afraid of the U.S. sanctions or they didn't want to deal with the country because of U.S. sanctions. And we have many, many cases, hundreds of cases of people now dealing with very lifelong complications as a result of this.
Mm-hmm. And Murtaza, you mentioned in your piece and previously also have reported that sanctions, while they succeed at essentially wrecking the middle class in the country and preventing Iranians from accessing necessities like medicine, food, sanctions fail to achieve the stated goals of Washington, which is forcing Iran to change its policy, foreign or domestic policy, or renegotiate the 2015 nuclear deal, the JCPOA, which the Trump administration pulled out of because they wanted a better deal. Now the Biden administration hasn't re-entered. And instead, the Iranian government has survived waves and waves of protests and mass protests and essentially popular angle by doubling down on repression, as you explain it. Talk about that, how basically this policy, essentially a failed policy of sanctions, has continued, but does not bring the stated results or goals.
Yeah, you know, there's a really interesting book that came out recently called Backfire by this woman named Agathe Desmarais. She's at the Economist Intelligence Unit. And effectively, it's about how the U.S. created this weapon of sanctions post 9/11, really refined it in an extraordinary way, and, you know, developed the kind of tools to put pressures on companies and banks around the world to impose secondary sanctions, as they're called. And she describes it in the book as like a doomsday machine that's impossible to turn off, or it's very difficult to turn off. So the U.S. kind of turned this doomsday machine on Iran under Obama, actually. And the goal was to get them to come back to the table to renegotiate or negotiate over their nuclear program. And it was a very difficult and sensitive and successful, ultimately, policy to use something short of military force to achieve a political goal. And, you know, the Iranians probably didn't want to, but they came back to the table and renegotiated a deal for the express purpose of, you know, integrating themselves in the global economy, and then in return, not developing a nuclear program. So it was really a win-win in many ways. Maybe the details of the deal may have been better for, we could have been more stringent or what have you, but ultimately they accomplished something which was quite rare in history. That's why the Europeans also were quite proud of this achievement as well, too. Now, when Trump came in, he took a very bull in the China shop approach to this. And obviously he had his own reasons related to wanting to spite Obama, who we had a personal rivalry with. But also, very obviously, he was influenced by people in DC and beyond who were very opposed to any deal at all and were hoping for nothing less than either US military conflict with Iran or the wholesale collapse of the Iranian government and replace with either a new government or simply an ungoverned Iran, which perhaps would be preferable. Now, the thing is, looking at history, I don't see any, I see one example really of a country which is pressed to renegotiate over sanctions, which was the Iran nuclear deal, the most prominent example. But I don't see any example of a country which was placed under sanctions and then the country simply collapsed or had a revolution as a result of that. Cuba has been under sanctions for many, many decades. The government has not collapsed. Venezuela, similarly. Iraq was under extremely intense sanctions in the 1990s, throughout the 1990s. It resulted in widespread humanitarian suffering. But it didn't result in Saddam Hussein collapsing. The U.S. government had to invade Iraq, ultimately, to make the government change. So there's very, very little evidence that sanctions cause governments to change, even very tough sanctions. There's a lot of evidence that they cause suffering civilian populations. But really, in any country, elites can always get access to what they want, regardless of how bad things get for the ordinary people economically. And in many ways, it seems to entrench their power, because when you immiserate a middle class and you send people in destitution, really it's the middle class which is often the engine of political change. They're in the position to be able to press for political change because they can think of something beyond their day-to-day survival economically. So I think U.S. sanctions on Iran, you know, many people really hate the Iranian government and they have very strong reasons for that and very understandable reasons. And they see sanctions as a way of punishing the government and changing the government. And I can understand that emotionally, but practically the track record does not show that that's what they do. It shows that really they entrench governments by making people poorer, and they inflict a lot of collateral damage without achieving any significant political goal. Now, I don't think that the Iranian government will ever really go back to, in any foreseeable time frame at least, go back to seriously negotiating a comprehensive nuclear deal or any deal with the U.S. to remove sanctions in exchange for political considerations. Because what that doomsday machine that I alluded to earlier has proven is that once you turn it on, you can't really turn it off, because other foreign companies and countries don't really believe that once a country's been sanctioned, it ever really gets reintegrated in the economy. They view it as really a global economy. They view it as a permanent sort of stain on a country, because there's no guarantee that when another administration comes in, they're not going to turn it back on, or there's no guarantee that it'll be safe for long-term investment that you kind of need to do to have any substantive economic return and engagement. Mm-hmm. So I think that really you've seen the permanent exclusion of Iran from the global financial system, barring a revolution or barring an uprising in Iran which overthrows the government. But really, you know, as much as I think that the sanctions as well as the Iranian government's own actions have probably indefinitely alienated the population from the government, ultimately what keeps the government in power is having all the guns and having control of the state apparatus. And I think the sanctions actually have made that even stronger, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Mortaza, you've also written about specifically when we're talking about the nuclear program, Biden administration's policy towards the country, how Iran is basically closer than ever to developing an actual nuclear weapon. I mean, it's still a civilian program, but if they were ever to choose, decide to break through and move from a civilian to an actual weapons program, they've gotten closer beyond the point, as you mentioned in one of your pieces, beyond the point where assassination, sabotage, even a campaign of airstrikes could significantly hinder its nuclear capacity. And you describe how this path, Iran's path, is, of course, in its own making, but also been helped along the way by President Biden's stubborn refusal to make compromises to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. Talk about that. We know your pieces from last year, but recently we've heard of some back channel talks with mediation, of course, of third countries between Tehran and Washington, the potential for maybe not an agreement on paper, but some understandings between the two sides. The U.S. is very interested in a prisoner swap to get U.S. dual nationals out of Iran. Iran is after the release of some of its blocked assets, billions of dollars held in South Korea and other countries at the request of US. And talk about basically how you see this policy, this administration's policy, considering that President Joe Biden, formerly Vice President President Obama, had actually promised to return to the nuclear deal when he was Canada Biden before he entered the White House, but has not really been able to reverse that era of maximum pressure of the previous administration, the Trump administration, and essentially make good on his promise.
Yeah, well, I think it goes back to sort of what I discussed earlier, what Agathe Demare discussed as well too, is that really, once the sanctions policy was put in place, it became a very uphill battle to ever unwind it. And I think that, you know, after the Trump administration, which had four full years of, you know, maximum pressure and doing everything they can to, you know, make impossible the future of diplomacy or make impossible the future of even sanctions removal on Iran under any circumstance, you know, it's very difficult to go back to that. And I think the administration could have, right when it came into office, treated the Trump years in aberration immediately and say, hey, you know, all of that was very extraordinary and out of the norm. And I think that the world sort of was hoping for that response as well, too. They didn't want to see the Trump administration as part of a, they didn't want to see it as a regular expression of U.S. power. They would like to have seen it and described it as an aberration. They could have gone right back to the deal, snapped back into it immediately and said that was that. But they didn't. Part of the reason was Iran was not, had reduced its compliance with the deal as well, too, in response to the U.S. withdrawing from it. And they waited. And I remember early in the Biden administration, former Iranian foreign minister Javad Zarif wrote an article in Foreign Affairs saying that Iran wants its deal back, the deal that they signed. Man, I saw that, you know, it's kind of a signal that the door was open to snapping back into the deal at the start of the administration. I think there's a lot of political pressure and then there was going to be a fight to do it because of the level of intense opposition to the deal that exists in more hawkish, you could say, quarters of Washington. And they didn't, and they waited. And, you know, in the time they waited, other things came up between the U.S. and Iran that soured the relationship. The protests against the Iranian government, which the Iranian government responded to in a very ugly way, also soured any desire to go back to talks with Iran or substantive talks with Iran. So then effectively saw the window close, or the window had narrowed to the point where it seems pretty clear that the JCPOA is dead. It's very hard to imagine it surviving. It's become like the Israel-Palestine peace process, or it's on the way to that. It's like a zombie sort of term you use to describe a process which everyone knows is not going anywhere. The well has been really poisoned. On the other hand, both these countries still need to talk to each other because they have mutual interests that they could, short-term interests at least, which can be addressed by some sort of mutual exchange. So you're seeing smaller deals for removal of specific restrictions on frozen funds, as you said, hostages, and things like that are likely to continue. But I don't see that the U.S. and Iran ever going back to the substantive agreement that they had, barring what I see is a pretty unlikely wholesale change in the Iranian government. Perhaps when the supreme leader dies and a new regime comes into place, it could have a different character and a very different character potentially, but I see no reason to assume that's the case. And nor do I see any imminent prospect of an uprising, returning a totally new government to Iran either. I think that's unlikely, not impossible, but unlikely. And absent that, I just don't see any real prospect of negotiations. I think that once the sanctions were put in place, in the first place, it became a very, very difficult matter, delicate matter of ever returning them. And that delicacy was sort of thrown out the window under the Trump administration, and now it's over. So, you know, I don't think that these talks are particularly impactful or important. What I do think is potentially more important are Iran's talks with its neighbors in the Arab countries. If they can reach a detente, which they may have under Chinese auspices, with Saudi Arabia, that could transform a lot more in the Middle East than the U.S., which I think is winding down its commitments more and focusing more exclusively on the Abraham Accords and things like that instead of a broader security compact.
I want to specifically talk about that. Iran and Saudi Arabia restoring ties to somewhat surprise of foreign policy watchers, with China brokering that agreement earlier this year. And we hear of back channel talks, potential mediation between Iran and other Arab countries, possibly Egypt, and more of this engagement coming. And you and I were talking about how the US is sort of pulling back or is less present in the region. And this may have created space for more engagement and essentially a road towards more the restoration of ties or peace between some of these countries. Talk about that, how you see the US, the lack of a US role in the region resulting in some of these positive engagements.
Well, you know, there are a lot of people who make US policy towards the region who definitely have the interests of the region in mind and they want to play a constructive role. But I think if you look at the broad scope of the U.S. position towards the Middle East, it's not been constructive. It's been very heavily influenced by U.S. domestic political considerations or an indifference or an ignorance of the dynamics of the region that they've gotten very heavily involved in. So a lot of people for many years made the argument that the U.S. presence is a negatively distorting factor in the Middle East. It's a very, very bad, big net negative for the people of the region. And absent such a large U.S. footprint, the leaders of the region will feel compelled to come to terms with one another, because some countries believe, rightly or wrongly, that they would have a de facto U.S. security umbrella, which emboldens them to act more aggressively or act in a more, you could say, obdurate or stubborn manner towards their neighbors. Absent that. And you can see Saudi Arabia is a country which has thought that at certain times. Israel has certainly thinks that today. So, you know, now that the U.S. is pulling back from parts of the region, and particularly Saudi Arabia seems to believe that it doesn't have a U.S. security guarantee, there's more incentive now to work with each other, talk to each other, than there would have been if you felt that you had an ironclad superpower backer on the outside who will underwrite your foreign policy and your own adventurism. So now that's gone, we see Iran and Saudi Arabia talking, which is a very positive potential sign for the future. The guarantee by China, I don't wonder how much China actually had involvement in working out the technical aspects of the arrangement, but the sponsorship, you could say, is very important, because anyone who violates the deal now risks making China look bad and poisoning the ties with the country, which looks set to invest a lot of money in the region and be more involved in some capacity in the years to come. So that's very important. So I think it's a positive effect of the drawdown we're seeing in the creation of a new security compact, which is indigenous, you could say, to the people of the region or the leaders of the region itself. And the U.S. seems to have been making, or seems to have made, or in the process of making, the Abraham Accords the centerpiece of its Middle East policy. So it's a very, very scaled down and far more modest approach to the region, which, you know, they spent trillions of dollars and thousands of American lives trying to shape over the last couple of decades. Now they're like the lawyer, the PR person for the Abraham Accords. And, you know, ultimately, I think that's an expression of foreign policy in the U.S. really, again, being beholden to domestic political concerns, or you could say D.C.-related concerns, as opposed to a broader assessment of what America's interests are in the region. And also, I think it's a very tough sell, because, look, if you look at Saudi Arabia's reported demands for being involved, the Abraham Accords, they're asking a very high price, and not from Israel, who they normalize with ostensibly, but from America. They're asking for support in the civilian nuclear program. They're asking for, again, security guarantees. And I think it's going to be very difficult for the U.S. to satisfy. They have to pay a very, very high price to satisfy what are ultimately Israeli political and security considerations, or even more discreetly, Benjamin Netanyahu's security and political considerations in some cases, for, you know, being involved in the Middle East and, you know, getting quite, returning to a sense of involvement in the Middle East. And it just seems not worth it. It seems a big cost to America. It seems a big investment of, you know, labor and time, ultimately to accomplish something which is not a direct U.S. security interest. It's a really an interest of a U.S. partner, you could say. So I think the U.S. drawing down from the region is probably good. It's a good thing for the region in the long term, although there'll likely be growing pains to that. And it's demotion to sort of the patron of the Abraham Accords is not really, doesn't really offer much to U.S. interests. And it could potentially have a lot of costs beyond what people see on the surface.
Well, on that note, Morteza, I want to thank you for coming back on the Iran podcast even before, but thanks again for this conversation.
It's my pleasure, Nigar. Thank you for having me.
That was Morteza Hossein, the senior reporter at The Intercept and co-host of their Intercepted podcast. And thank you for listening to another episode of the Iran podcast. You can find us on all major podcast apps, so please subscribe and leave a review and rating for us. That will help us be seen and heard more. You can also support our work by going to Spotify and sponsoring the Iran podcast. You can follow us on Twitter, where we will post about episodes and new guests. Our Twitter handle is at Iran Podcast. I'm your host, Negar Murtazavi, and until next week, goodbye.